Osho, Sufis, The People of the Path, Volume 1, Talks on Sufism, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India, Discourse Number 13.
Bhagwan, Hassan of Basra relates, I had convinced myself that I was a man of humility and less than humble in my thoughts and conduct to others. Then one day I was standing on the bank of a river when I saw a man sitting there. Beside him was a woman, and before them was a wine flask. I thought, if only I could reform this man and make him like I am, instead of the degenerate creature that which he is. At that moment, I saw a boat in the river beginning to sink. The other man at once threw himself into the water where 7 people were struggling and brought 6 of them safely to the bank. Then the man came up to me and said, Hassan, if you are a better man than me, in the name of God save the other man, the last remaining one. I found that I could not even save one man, and he was drowned. Now this man said to me, this woman here is my mother. This wine flask has only water in it. This is how you judge, and this is what you are like. I threw myself at his feet and cried out, as you have saved 6 out of these 7 in peril, save me from drowning in pride, disguised as merit. The stranger said, I pray that God may fulfill your aim.
Jesus says, judge ye not. His statement is absolute, with no qualifications. It is categorical. He does not say, don't judge wrongly. He simply says, judge ye not. Don't judge at all. He makes no distinction between right judgment and wrong judgment. His statement declares that all judgment is wrong. Judgment as such is wrong. This is a tremendously powerful statement. And the same is the attitude of Sufism about life. A real man of God has no judgment. He can't judge. It is impossible for him to judge. First, to judge, you need to be an egoist. The ego is a must. Judgment is possible only if you are standing egocentrically. If you have no ego left, who is going to judge? And how? And in comparison to what? The real man of God exists as a nothing. He is emptiness. What Buddha calls sunyata. He is non-being. Inside, in him, there is no one except God. He is one with the all. He cannot make a distinction of I and thou. He cannot stand against the thou in any way, because there is no I left. So there cannot be any thou. He is one with all. With a thief, he is a thief. With a saint, he is a saint. He cannot stand against. he cannot even stand far. Because to stand against or to stand far, you need an ego. That's the basic requirement. He cannot judge because he is not. When Jesus says, judge ye not, he is saying, please disappear. The judgment won't allow your ego to disappear. It will keep feeding it. It will keep strengthening it. So those who judge become very, very egoistic. They are not the religious people. Not the people of the path. Second thing, to judge, you need criterions, rules, paradigms. Rules come from the past. Rules come from the history. And life always goes on transcending history. History is where it was once, but it is no more there. So all rules are inadequate. They belong to the dead past. They have nothing to say about the alive present. Martin Luther has said that faith is based in history. That is an utterly absurd statement and very un-Christian. Faith is not based in history. Faith is based in your own experience of life here now. It has nothing to do with the past. The past is no more. The past is nothing but footprints on the banks of time. Life has moved from there. Just as sometimes a snake moves out of its old skin. To judge the alive snake by the dead skin will be foolish. To judge man by history is nonsense. But without history there is no other criterion. You cannot judge from the past because it is no more. You cannot judge from the future because it is not yet. And by the time you will find a criterion to judge man in the present would have become past. It is each moment changing. Life is a process, a flux. Life is unpredictable. No rule contains it. No rule can contain it. It is uncontainable. It has an absolute freedom. It goes on moving in new directions, new ways. It goes on finding new pastures of joy and bliss and ecstasy. Rules come from the past. That's why every society has different rules, because every society has a different history. Hindus have lived in one way, in a one kind of climate, in one country. Mohammedans have lived in another way, and in another kind of climate. Tibetans is still again in a totally different way. Their histories are different. That's why their moralities are different. That's why their rules are different. Those rules are all arbitrary. They are utilitarian. They have nothing of reality in them. Yes, they help at a certain moment of time. But once life has moved beyond that moment, they are just hangovers, ugly, burdening, heavy, make you dull. Martin Luther is not right. He was not really a man of God. He was more of a politician, more of a Protestant, protesting, fighting. More of a revolutionary, but has not the religious consciousness. Faith is not based in any history. Faith is based in experience. And when I say experience, I mean experiencing. Because once one experience has become complete, it is past. While you are in it, passing, alive, throbbing, dancing, only then and there, you can contact God. And with that contact arises faith. Faith is not a conditioning. It is your own experience of the divine in life. So remember, faith is not based in the history of the race. It is not even based in your own autobiography. It is not autobiographical. The real man of faith has no autobiography. That's why in the East we have a tradition that the sannyasin should not write his autobiography, because he should not think in terms of autobiography. If you ask a sannyasin from where he comes, he will laugh. To what society he belongs, he will laugh. What was his old name, he will laugh. He will not give you any clue about his past. Yogananda is the first Hindu sannyasin who has written an autobiography. The autobiography of a yogi. Otherwise, the sannyasis have always insisted that they don't have any past. They efface their past. They have only the present. The now is all that they have. Hence the freedom, the absolute freedom of the sannyasin, because he has no past. So he is not imprisoned anywhere. He has no autobiography. Just think, if you can drop your autobiography completely, how free you will become in that very instant. And that is the meaning of my sannyas too. When I give you sannyas, what in fact I am telling you is, drop your history, drop your autobiography. Now no more be connected with your past. Become discontinuous with it. Now live the moment. And live the moment with clarity, intelligence, awareness, love. But not according to rules. Rules come from the past. Love arises here now. Intelligence is here now. Rules come from the past. And always remember, a person who lives through rules is bound to be unintelligent. In fact, to live according to rule is just a way to avoid intelligence. Then you can afford to be stupid. There is no problem. The rule takes care. You don't feel responsible. You are simply following a certain dead rule. You are following it perfectly. Then you need not be intelligent. What is the point of being intelligent? You go to the church every Sunday. You don't go out of your own inspiration. You simply go as a rule. You pray a certain prayer that has been given by the tradition down the ages. You simply repeat it. You are a gramophone record. It is not in any way connected with you and your heart. It is not your pulsation. It is not your vibe. It is not you. It is tradition is speaking through you. It is other people's voices ringing through you, resounding through you. You are just an echo. How the echo can be intelligent? People who don't want to be intelligent become followers. Followers of tradition. Followers of scriptures. Followers of rules and regulations, rituals. An intelligent person has no rules, no rituals. And I don't mean that he is insane. And I don't mean that he is irresponsible. And I don't mean that he will hurt others. No, not at all. In fact, just the contrary is the case. Because he will live intelligently, he cannot hurt anybody. The people who follow the rules are always violent people. Violence comes out of stupidity. Nonviolence is a flowering of intelligence. Intelligence and love always go together. The more intelligent you are, the more loving. The more loving you are, the more intelligent. They are two aspects of the same coin. By intelligent, I don't mean intellectual. Remember, the intellectual is not the intelligent person. The intellectual is again living in the past. He can recite the Vedas. He cannot create a single richa, a single poetry of the quality of the Vedas. He can recite Gita or Quran or Bible, but he cannot sing a single song of the quality of Gita. He cannot express himself in any creative way the way Muhammad did. His utterances are borrowed. His utterances have no life in them. His utterances no heart to beat. They don't breathe. They don't have that aliveness that Jesus' utterances have. He will be intellectual. He will be a pandit, a scholar. And through being intellectual, you can deceive yourself and others that you are intelligent. Intelligence has nothing to do with intellect. Intellect is part of memory. Intelligence is part of your heart. They are totally different phenomena. Sometimes you can find a farmer, a woodcutter, a fisherman, very intelligent, but not intellectual, certainly not intellectual. He may not know anything about the scriptures and the theories and the philosophies. Jesus had all his apostles non-intellectual people, but they were immensely intelligent. To be with Jesus, one needs intelligence, not intellect. Those people were simple people, but they had clarity. They could see the radiance of Jesus, what has happened. The professors could not see. The fishermen, the woodcutters, the gardeners, they could see. The rabbis could not see. They thought this man is mad. They thought this man is dangerous. They compared notes with the past. They thought this man is not fulfilling the old law. In fact, they thought, this man is against all laws and all regulations and rules. This man is a danger to society. And yes, this man was a danger to society. Because this society that has existed up to now is not worth calling a society. It is an ant heap. It is an anonymous mass. People are lost into it, drowned into it. People have lost their souls into it. When a man becomes mass, he has forgotten himself completely. A man has to be a man. A man has to be an individual. A man has to have his own life, his own lifestyle. A man has to have his own way of doing things, his own uniqueness. Only then he fulfills. Only then he becomes closer to God. God loves the creators, not the people who are lost in the anonymous mass and have become part of society, of history, of race, of religion, of church. God would like you to see, to be yourself. A Hasid, Joshua, was dying. And somebody told the master that remember Moses so that he can help you. You are going to die. Remember Moses. Joshua opened his eyes, laughed and said, stop all this nonsense. Sooner or later, I am going to be encountering God. It is a question of few minutes or few hours at the most. I am on my dying bed. Stop all this nonsense. I will be standing before God and God will not ask me, Joshua, why you are not a Moses? He will ask me, Joshua, why you are not a Joshua? Yes, God will ask you why you are not you. Why you are somebody else? By being somebody else, you remain unfulfilled. By being somebody else, you are a traitor to God. So the real man of God lives his own life, lives intelligently, lives lovingly, lives understandingly, with great compassion, but has no fixed rules. He is liquid. He is not frozen. How can he judge against what and how? Just think in this way. If you are a born Jaina or a Buddhist, born, I am saying, not one who has really attained to Buddhahood, not one who has tasted something of Buddhahood or Jainahood. If you are just a born Jaina or a Buddhist and you see Jesus sitting with his friends, drinking wine, what you are going to think? Won't you judge? You will immediately judge that this man can't be the Son of God. Mahavira never drank wine. Buddha never drank, not even in his dreams. And this man is drinking wine. If you are a Christian, a born Christian, and you see Mahavira standing naked, you will think he is crazy or something. Jesus was never naked. This man has gone neurotic. This is not the way a man of God should be. Never in the history of Christianity there has been a naked mystic. So what he is doing, this man Mahavira, he must be wrong. This is how we go on judging. We have a certain pattern, a certain idea transferred to us by our history, by our race, church, religion. And then with that idea we are prejudiced. With that idea we think we have a priori knowledge of what should be the case. Then we can judge. A man of God has no fixed rules and idea. He belongs to no history, to no race, to no religion, to no church. He belongs only to his innermost core. He has nothing there as a fixed idea so that he can judge. A real man of God will be able to see Jesus and recognize Jesus even when he is drinking wine with his friends. And he will be able to recognize Buddha. And he will be able to recognize Mahavira in his nakedness. And he will be able to recognize Krishna also, playing on his flute, with his girlfriends dancing around him. Now, if you are too much of a Christian, you think the man of God has to be always on the cross. That is just one instance. It happened once that Jesus was on the cross. But that is not a rule. There is another possibility also, the Krishna playing on his flute, arrayed in beautiful clothes, decorated beautifully, dancing. Now, you cannot conceive Christ dancing. If you are too much fixated upon Christ, you will not be able to see what is happening in Krishna. Or, if you are too much fixated on Krishna, then you will not be able to see what is happening in Christ. God manifests in millions of ways. Krishna and Christ, Mahavira and Buddha and Muhammad and Zarathustra and Lao Tzu, and millions of ways. And all ways are His. But to recognize that you will need great intelligence. And the first step towards intelligence is to drop all a priori ideas, prejudices. To drop all that has been given by others to you. To drop all the dust from your mind so you can become a pure mirror and you can reflect. First, the man of God has disappeared as an ego. There is no I to say anything against or for. Second, he has no fixed rules. So he cannot weigh who is doing right and who is doing wrong. Third, a great acceptance has arisen in his soul. Total acceptance has arisen in his being. All is good, because all is from God. Yes, he can bless the whole, because he is so blessed by the whole. He has no judgment. That is the meaning when Jesus says, "Judge ye not." So remember, there are no right judgments and no wrong judgments. Judging as such is wrong. Drop judging. And if you can drop judging, you will be surprised how many burdens, how many rocks from your heart have been dropped. You will feel weightless. You will almost feel like flying. You are chained in your prejudices. You are chained by your past. That's why you feel life so heavy. Life is not heavy. It is your carrying of the past that is making it heavy. That's why children are light and old people become very heavy, because the children have no autobiographies yet. As they will grow up, they will start gathering, accumulating junk, experiences, knowledge, this and that. And sooner or later they will be drowned in their own past. Judgment is moral. And morality has nothing to do with religion. That misunderstanding has to be dropped. People always confuse morality with religion. Morality has nothing to do with religion. A moral man is not necessarily a religious man. An atheist can be moral, perfectly moral. You can find the moral man in Soviet Russia. There is no need for the moral man to be religious. A religious man is a new dimension. Morality is a need of the society. The society needs rules and regulations. The society needs distinctions, what is right and what is wrong and what is good and what is bad. It certainly needs, because people are so asleep. To manage these sleepy people, you need some demarcations. You have to give them some fixed rules, otherwise there would be chaos. The religious man can drop his morality, because now he has his own eyes. He need not have any other guides. His eyes are enough. It is as if you were blind and you used to have a stick to walk around, to grope your way, to find your way by the stick. Then one day your eyes open. Will you still carry the stick? You will throw it. Now it is meaningless. Now you don't need to grope. Now the walking stick is no more a help. It will be a burden. So is morality. It is a walking stick for a blind man. For those who have decided to remain stupid, morality is needed. But for those who have decided to stake everything and become alert and aware, morality is no more needed. A person who is aware is spontaneously moral. He need not carry any morality around him. He is simply moral. Not that he tries to do good. No, not at all. But whatsoever he does is good. See the distinction. It is of immense import. The religious man is one who is not concerned with doing good, but whatsoever happens through him is good, because he has surrendered himself to God, and all is good through God, through surrender to him. He cannot do wrong. It is not possible. It is impossible to do wrong when you are alert. It is as impossible to do wrong when you are alert as it is impossible to walk through the wall or to try to walk through the wall when your eyes are open. You will find the doors. It is as simple as that. But a blind man sometimes tries to get out of the wall. Cannot. There is no possibility. But a blind man is a blind man. He cannot see where is the wall and where is the door. The religious man is one whose eyes are open and he sees where is the door. Then there is no need to carry any idea that I should always go through the door. One simply goes through the door. when you know, that very knowing becomes your virtue. Socrates says, knowledge is virtue. A very pregnant statement. To know is to be right. To know is to do right. Through knowing, right comes on its own, like a shadow. Virtue is a byproduct of right knowing. It need not be practiced. If you practice, it is false. The practiced morality is a false morality. It creates only hypocrites. The morality that is not practiced at all, that which happens simply because you know, your eyes are open, you can feel, you are sensitive. So, the wrong cannot happen anymore. The religious person is neither moral nor immoral. He is simply religious. Religion is a higher standpoint than morality. Morality is an effort to pretend to be religious. With morality, judgment goes. When morality goes, judgment goes. If morality is there, you will be always judging. That's why the moralists, the Puritans, they are continuously judging. Their whole day and night, 24 hours are of judgment. They are comparing. Always looking. They are peeping toms. They are looking into everybody's life, what you are doing. And who is doing the wrong? Their whole life is that of continuous inspection. These are ugly people. It is very difficult to live with a moralist. He is utterly boring. He is dull and dead, and he creates a dull and dead atmosphere around himself. Unfortunate are those who have to live with moralistic people. Because those moralistic people sooner or later will poison them too. The moralist creates guilt. And guilt is the cancer of the soul. Once you become guilty, you are ill. And it will be very difficult for you to regain your health again. But all the so-called religions, which are not religions but only moral standpoints, have done that harm. Jesus' statement, judge ye not, when looked meditatively, is one of the most revolutionary statements ever made. Judging takes it for granted as if the man exists for the rules. That is putting things upside down. That is putting things into a complete disorder. Man does not exist for the morals. Morals exist for man. Man is not the means, man is the end. But the moralist always thinks the rule is more important than the man. The man can be sacrificed for the rule. But the rule cannot be sacrificed for the man. The rule becomes more important. This is a very sorry state of affairs. The rule cannot be more important than the man. The rule exists to help man. It is as if you sacrifice the blind man for the walking stick. Yes, the walking stick is helpful, but it is not the end or the goal. Watch how you judge people. When you judge people, are you not making the moral principle the end? Are you not condemning the man and praising the principle? Things should be put in right order. Principles are there to be used. They are arbitrary. They are only conveniences. They have no intrinsic value. When times change, circumstances change, man attains to new ways of being and life, they have to be dropped. They should be dropped. They should be immediately dropped. They should not become a burden on humanity. Now, rules go on living. Times have changed. The Hindu code of life was written 5,000 years before. It is still the ideal. In these 5,000 years, how much water has flown down the Ganges? Everything has changed. Nothing remains the same as it was in the days of Manu. And Manu has written the code, and it is still being followed. It is utter nonsense now to follow it. It has nothing to say to this age, and to this man, and to this time. And Manu is not responsible, because whatsoever he has written was meaningful, meaningful in his time. If he comes back, she will not be able to believe that how foolish people can be. Why you are following these rules now, he will say. Who told you to follow them? Life has changed. Life is no more the same. Nothing is any more the same. But those rules continue. Moses has given a certain pattern of life to be lived, but it is 3,000 years old. The world has gone far away from that point. It is irrelevant, but people go on following. We are worshippers of the dead. We are worshippers of all that becomes irrelevant. We don't look into life. Each and every moment one has to look into life and find a way out of it. One has to respond to life, not to dead codes. Now Jesus is also 2,000 years old. So is Buddha, 2,500 years old. And the Jnana code of life is one of the most ancient codes, near about 5,000 or 7,000 years old. Modern man is burdened. If you follow it, it is inadequate. It makes you impossible to live. If you don't follow it, you start feeling guilty. So both the ways, it is destructive. If you follow Manu, Moses, Mahavira, you will be a museum piece. You will not be here now. You will not be relevant at all. You can go and see the Jnana Munis, the Jnana monks. They are irrelevant. They should be discarded. They belong to the dustbin. They are no more relevant to the time. Just corpses. If you follow the rule, this is bound to happen. you will not be contemporary. You will be a contemporary of Manu, or Mahavira, or Moses, but you will not be a contemporary to me. You will not be contemporary to the society and to the world in which you are living. You will not belong to this 20th century. To belong to this century, all the past centuries have to be dropped. And if you cannot do it, and it is impossible to do it, it is so difficult to do it that nobody can do it perfectly. How you can belong to 5,000 years old codes living in 20th century? It is such a feat that you can try your best, but you will remain always imperfect and always feeling falling short and the guilt that you are not being as good as you should be, that you are not a real religious person. And it will be like a wound, and it will make your life a misery. Very few people try it, to follow those rules. People simply have found a way to pay lip service. This is just to protect themselves. But even the lip service does harm, because deep down you think they are right and I am wrong. If I am not following, then I am wrong. And this idea that I am wrong will make you shrink, will make you closed, will not make you open, and will not give you thrill and joy that is needed to grow. One has to accept one's reality so totally that there is no guilt, not even a shadow of guilt. Only then somebody flowers and blooms. Only a guiltless person blooms. And when I say guiltless, I don't mean that follow these rules and don't commit any sin, then you will be guiltless. Nobody can be. When I say be guiltless, I mean drop all the rules which create guilt. Be without rules. Trees are perfectly existing without rules. They are guiltless. Stars are existing without rules. They are guiltless. Be natural. Be guiltless. Only with one difference. That difference is that you will have to be aware. Trees cannot be aware. They are guiltless but not aware. That's why they are in God, but they cannot know that they are in God. Stars are guiltless but not aware. So they move in God. They move far smoothly, far totally in God than we move, but they cannot know it. They remain unconscious. This is man's dignity and man's potential. To be in God and to be fully aware. To be in God and consciously. This brings the greatest joy, the celebration. Judge ye not. And this statement of Jesus is not only concerned about others. This is the last thing I would like you to be reminded. Few people start thinking, okay, we will not judge about others. If somebody is passing and doing something, we will say, we are not concerned, this is his business. Who I am to judge? Yes, it is possible not to judge others, but if you go on judging yourself, it is the same game being played on another plane. First you were judging others, now you start judging yourself. I have done this wrong. I should not have done this. Tomorrow I will improve upon myself. I have to evolve and become spiritual and this and that. You have ideals and you think you have to fulfill them. So you may not judge others, but you are judging yourself. It is the same. Now you will be destructive to yourself. Judge ye not means simply judge ye not. Neither the other nor oneself. Judgment has to disappear. Be without judgment and see what great joy comes to you. What great ecstasy starts exploding in you. Before we enter this beautiful story, few things that will help you to understand it. There are four possibilities between the subject and the object, between the inner and the outer. The first possibility is that of the politician, the moralist, the priest. The politician is only interested how to manipulate people. His only interest in the other is how to manipulate him, how to dominate him, how to become powerful over him. He is not concerned with anything else. His trip is that of power. How to control people. If he says something, he says with that idea. He is not concerned about truth. That's why politicians have to go on telling lies, promising things which they know they cannot fulfill, which they know are not possible to fulfill. But they go on promising, because that's what you need. That's what you desire. And if they want to manipulate you, they have to tickle your desire. They have to buttress you. They have to show you beautiful dreams. The politician talks in order to manipulate the other person. His whole concern is exploitative. And so is the priest. It is not very different. He also tries to manipulate the other. His idea of power is not of this world. His idea of power is of that world. But it is of power. He also wants to dominate in the name of God. Politician and the priest are not very different. That's why they have always been together. There has been a conspiracy between the priest and the politician to dominate people. In the old days, it was so, and today, it is so. The politician and the priest have always been together conspiring against people. The priest used to say to people that the king is from God. And the king in his own turn will go and touch the feet of the priest. This is the conspiracy. They have a mutual understanding. They had decided long before that their goal is the same. And they have a demarcated line that the priest should rule the people's soul and the politician should rule the people's bodies. The politician should not interfere as far as soul matters are concerned, and the priest should not interfere as far as body matters are concerned. This was an understanding and a conspiracy. This is one way of relating with people. The other way of relating is of the poet. The painter, the artist, the singer, the dancer, he is not concerned with manipulating, dominating, not at all. In fact, he is not concerned much with the other. His expression is subjective. It is an outpouring of his being. The politician, the priest are objective. Their goal is the others. The artist, the poet, the painter, the dancer, he is not objective, he is subjective. He talks, relates, but his talking and relating is an inspired ejaculation. His explosion. If he wants the other there, then he wants only the other to be the ideas. So the other can also enjoy. The poet wants to share. The dancer dances. If he wants you to be there, it is just only so that the dance can be shared by you, with you. He has some joy and he would like to relate it. He would like it to be spread to everybody. He has some fragrance and he wants it to give it to the winds so they can take to the farthest corner of the world. But he is not interested in dominating. That's why the poet has remained very poor. The painter has remained poor. They have remained powerless. They don't have any power. They are the most non-violent people, but powerless. I have heard that a man went to his physician and he said, for many days I am suffering from constipation. The priest prescribed some medicine. And the man was so poor that he said, I cannot purchase it. So the physician gave the medicines from his own money. After 2-3 days, the man came again and he said, nothing has happened. Still constipation continues. The physician was puzzled. He said, this medicine functions absolutely. And the man is looking so poor, so exhausted, that he asked, what kind of work do you do? He said, I am a poet. And the physician laughed. He said, why didn't you say it before? Now take this money, first go and eat. But this has been the situation. The poet is poor. The painter is poor. When somebody wants to become a poet, the family thinks a calamity has come. They are neither priests nor politicians. They are not concerned with the other in any way to dominate them, to be powerful over them. If they invite you, it is an invitation. If you come to them, they are very happy and grateful to you. They have some gift. They want it to be shared. But they are subjective. The politician is interested in the other, the poet is interested in himself. Both are half-half, unbalanced. Both are part, not the whole. The third possibility is of the mystic, the saint, the sage. He is whole. He is neither subjective nor objective. Subject and object meet in him. I and thou meet and become one. He is not interested in manipulating, in overpowering, and he is not only interested in sharing some poetry with you. No. He has some truth, not poetry only, not a dream, not a beautiful painting. He has God himself to be shared. But his sharing is such that it can be shared only when you become one with him and he becomes one with you. The poet can share his poetry, there is no need to become one with the poet. Only one requirement is there, that you should be sympathetic and rapturous. That's all. That you should be able to listen. That's all. For a moment, you should not judge. Who bothers to judge poetry or music? If one enjoys, one remains there, otherwise one leaves. The poet requires only a momentary participation with him. The mystic wants you to come to him so close that your boundaries start disappearing, melting. That is the relationship between a master and a disciple. By and by, they become one. When they become one, only then the truth can be shared. That which has happened into the innermost core of the master can be delivered to the disciple. But it is not a thing, so it cannot be delivered if you are separate. It is a feel. It can be delivered only when you become one. When there is an inner contact. It is not possible to deliver only in relationship. It is only possible to deliver it when there is a unity, not only relationship. The poet needs the relationship, the politician does not need even relationship. The master, the mystic needs unity. The politician does not want even relationship. Politicians don't have friendships. They only pretend. They don't allow people to come very close. It is dangerous to allow people to come very close. The politician remains far away, aloof. He never comes close, and he will not allow anybody to come close. He has to be constantly defensive. When people come close, you cannot dominate them so easily. Politicians don't like to fall in love. Adolf Hitler never allowed a single woman to sleep with him in his room. He was so afraid. There was not a single man in the whole of Germany who had any friendship with Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler could not afford it. The distance had to be maintained. He was far away. And people were just people, masses. The politician needs no relationship. The poet needs relationship. But the poet and the admirer remain separate. The mystic needs unity. The master and the disciple become one. The politician is always judging, continuously judging. He is a moralist. Whatsoever is your morality, he will follow it. He will fulfill it. And sometimes, beautiful games are played. In India, it happens every day. India is a very, very ancient country with a long history of morality and moral ideas. Now, in India, politicians try to fulfill those moral ideas. If some politician fulfills it, he becomes a great saint and a Mahatma. He is not going to solve any problem of the country. But if he can just sow gimmicks, for example, the president of India just now has decided that the country is so poor that he will move into a smaller house. A beautiful gesture. But how, by your moving into a smaller house, the country is going to become rich and the whole country is happy? This is how people are stupid. The whole country is happy. The country is saying, this is how the leaders should be. Now the real problem is not touched at all. The real problem is how people should get more food. Just by the president moving into a smaller house is not going to help anybody. But that's how people are. So stupid that they will praise it like anything. Now this man is almost like a Mahatma. They will reduce their salaries and they will be praised like Mahatmas. And not a single problem is solved. What does it matter? The president receives 10,000 rupees per month. He had decided that he will receive only 3,000 rupees per month. Perfectly good. But by just giving 7,000 rupees to the country, a country of 600 million people, what are you doing? But the country feels good. The country feels perfectly at ease that this is how things should be done. These are tricks to manipulate. Ugly. Basically ugly. On the surface look beautiful. The politician goes on pretending that he is a moralist. Because the people follow a certain kind of morality. He has to sow at least. Now there are other ways to get the money from the back door, so there is no trouble. You can drop 7,000 rupees from here, you can get 70,000 from other sources. And nobody will suspect, because a Mahatma who is living in a small house and has reduced his salary and moves in a smaller car and like this, nobody will ever suspect that from the back door something totally different is going on. If you really want your back door functioning, then you have to sew on your front door a great moralistic mask. India is poor, and the politicians has been doing these tricks for 30 years. The same tricks. One Prime Minister, Lal Bahadur Shastri, seeing that the country is very poor, used to fast one day every week. But how this is going to help? Impotent gestures. Just befooling people. Just putting people's mind to some other non-essential things. Diverting their minds from the real problems. And people are also not interested to solve the real problems, because to solve the real problems they will have to change their minds. They don't want to change their minds. They want to remain as they are, and they want to solve their problems, and they want to remain as they are. And the problems arise out of their being as they are. So the problems cannot be solved unless they change. Unless their mind starts taking new ways of being. But that is hard and that hurts. The politician lives through a mask. He never relates. He never relates to people. He never relates to real problems. He only creates false problems and false challenges, and he starts showing that he is fighting hard and he is doing great good to people, and the good never happens. The poet is not concerned with the other at all. His only concern is like a flower. He is a flower. He blooms. Yes, good, whatsoever he has, he shares. It is better than to be a politician. To be a poet is far better. It is higher, spiritually higher. the real thing happens through the mystic, because he is ready to dissolve himself into the other, and he is ready to absorb the other into himself. He is ready to stake all. He really changes people's minds, because he gives them a new quality of consciousness, a new dimension. But he is not a moralist. So people are never for the mystic. They are against the mystic. They are always for the politician, because the politician is a moralist. The politician looks as if he is their leader, and the mystic always looks dangerous. Christ, Buddha, Muhammad, they are all dangerous people. Because the mystic really is ready to change the whole quality of your consciousness, and through that revolution, your all problems will disappear. Your problems are created by you, and unless you change, they cannot be solved. Your misery is created by you. It cannot be changed unless you are radically changed. A radical change is needed. But the mystic is not a moralist, and sometimes he may look even a moral person, because he will not follow the old morality. He will has his own morality that comes out of moment-to-moment response to reality. He will look into reality, and from there his life arises. He may look immoral. Jesus looked immoral. Sufis have always looked immoral. This has to be understood. The politician looks perfectly moral. The mystic looks perfectly immoral. And the poet is amoral. He has nothing to do with morality or immorality. He is neither orthodox nor revolutionary. He is a flower. You can enjoy or not enjoy. He is not there to solve any of your problems. Neither he promises, nor he solves. The politician promises, but never solves. The mystic never promises and solves. And the poet is just in between the two. These are the three approaches. Now, this is small story. Hasan of Basra relates, I had convinced myself that I was a man of humility and less than humble in my thoughts and conduct to others. I had convinced myself, says Hasan, that I was a man of humility. He was a man of morality, not a man of humility. A man of humility cannot know that he is humble. Humility never becomes self-conscious. Otherwise, it is not humility at all. Once the self has entered into it, how you can call it humility? If you start thinking, I am the most humble man in the world, then you are still pretending to be the first in the world. It is again an ego trip. I had convinced myself that I was a man of humility. You can convince yourself if you follow dead, rotten rules. You can convince yourself that I am now following all the rules, and I am suffering so much, and I am torturing myself, and I am being so much ascetic, and I am sacrificing so much life. I am a man of humility. And Sufis have great respect for humbleness. But a true humbleness is unaware of itself. It knows not. it has no idea. How can you know your humbleness? To know, you will have to compare with others. And to compare with others, you will need an ego. Only ego can be compared. I can say that I am a man of knowledge if I compare my knowledge with somebody. If I am left alone in the world, I cannot claim that I am a man of knowledge. If I say I am a man of morality, moral man, but if I am alone then, if the whole world disappears and I am left alone, then how I can claim I am a moral man? There will be nobody to be compared with. Real humbleness is non-comparative. You can be humble even if there is nobody. A humble man is simply humble. Whether somebody is there or not makes no difference. If somebody is needed for you to be humble, then your humbleness depends on him. It is a dependence. And if that man tries to become more humble than you, then what will happen? He can do that. If you can be humble, he can be more humble than you. If he becomes more humble than you, then again. It is relative. I have heard the young fellow was a chronic speed offender who picked up 2 tickets a day from the motorcycle cop, one going to work and the other returning home. Finally, he bought a souped-up foreign car, capable of traveling 150 miles per hour, traveling home in it at a speed of around 70 miles per hour. He was again accosted by the speed cop, who pulled up alongside of him to flag him down. Quickly stepping on the gas, he pulled away from the motorcyclist and started traveling at 100 miles per hour. Eventually, he slowed down, waiting for the motorcycle cop to catch up with him again. As the motorcycle pulled alongside, he pushed the pedal all the way down and took off at 140 miles per hour. Becoming worried because he could not see the cop following him, he turned the car around and went back to look for him. To his surprise, he found the cop crawling out from under his machine in the ditch. "What happened to you, officer?" he asked the bruised and bleeding cop. "Well," explained the police officer, "when you pulled away from me the last time, I thought my motorcycle has stopped, so I stepped off." It is relative. If your humbleness is relative, it is not true humbleness. It is still egoistic. All comparison is of the ego. Hassan says, "I had convinced myself." It is very easy to convince yourself. You can convince anything to yourself. That's how people go on living. Somebody has convinced himself that he is a lover. And somebody has convinced himself that he is humble. And somebody has convinced himself that he is a meditator, and so on and so forth. That's why you are constantly coming in conflict with reality. You have convinced that you are a lover, but every day there is a problem. And you cannot convince your woman that you are a lover. That's why there is conflict. It is very easy to convince yourself, and to convince about good things naturally is more easy. Who does not want to be humble, pure, innocent? Who does not want to be a saint, a sage? This Hassan says, "I had convinced myself that I was a man of humility, humble in my thoughts and conduct to others. Then one day I was standing on the bank of a river when I saw a man sitting there. Beside him was a woman, and before them was a wine flask. I thought, if only I could reform this man and make him like I am instead of the degenerate creature which he is. Now this is what goes on happening in everybody's mind. You have a certain idea of yourself, and from that idea you go on looking at others and continuously condemning, judging, continuously throwing thoughts around yourself, interpreting. And it feels very good whenever you see somebody who is degenerate. It feels very good. On the surface you so much concerned, but deep down you feel very good, because that degenerate man makes you feel bigger than you are. Now Hasan is convinced even more that he is the man of humbleness, morality, purity. He is pious. Remember, a real man of God has no condemnation. If sometimes he finds you doing something wrong, he has no condemnation. And if he tells you that this is wrong, his statement is concerned only with the act, not with you. If he says that something is wrong, he is saying only about the action and nothing about you. You remain untouched by your action. And if he says something is wrong, he is concerned because he loves you, not because he loves a moral principle. Not that drinking is bad, but if he says that don't drink, he is concerned with your health, not with any principle that drinking is bad. It may not be in all the cases. Sometimes it may function as a medicine. Then it is perfectly good. Sometimes it may be needed. It may be a requirement. And then it is good. His condemnation does not exist. There is no condemnation. If sometimes he says something is wrong, he does not make it look like a sin. It is wrong only in the sense of a mistake, an error. You think 2 and 2 make 5. And I say to you, no, this is wrong. But I am not saying that you are a sinner. I am simply saying that your mathematics has to be put right. You are perfectly good, just you are committing a mistake. See the difference. In fact, for a religious man there are no sins, only mistakes. And then too, he will not enforce it on you. He will simply tell it to you. It will be an advice, not a commandment. If you don't follow it, you don't become a criminal, and you are not to be thrown in a hell. You are not to be punished for it. Your freedom remains intact. To my sannyasins, I would like it to remember. Whatsoever I say to you, remember always, it is not to destroy your freedom, not even to touch it. If you feel it right, you can do it. If you don't feel it right, you need not do it. By not doing, never feel guilty. I am the last person in the world to make you feel guilty in any way. I respect you. My respect is absolute. And whenever I say something to you that this is not right, I am simply saying that this is an error. But still you remain free to follow my advice or not to follow. Sometimes it happens a sannyasini will come to me and he will say, I have not followed your advice and I am feeling very guilty. That is wrong. That is absolutely wrong. Then you are doing something to yourself unnecessarily. You need not feel guilty. It is worse than the wrong thing that you have done. Guilt is the last wrong that one can do to oneself. There is no need. If you decided to do otherwise, you are perfectly free to do otherwise. And don't be worried that you will go far away from me because you are not following my advice. No. You will go far away from me only if you start feeling guilty. My love is unconditional. Whether you follow me or not does not matter. It has no relevance with my love. In fact, you will be closer to me the more free you are from me. Let it be remembered always. My whole interest in you is to make you free as a human being is possible to become. My whole interest is to liberate you. So the more liberated you are, the more closer you are to me. If you find that my advice is good, not because I have given it to you, but because you find it is good, then follow it. Then you are not following me. That's what Buddha has said to his disciples. That don't follow me. Not because Buddha has said so. Not because it is written in the scripture. Not because all the sages are agreed upon it. No. Unless your intelligence says, yes, this is right, don't follow it. And the same I would like to tell to you. I thought if only I could reform this man and make him like I am, instead of the degenerate creature which he is. Now this is not a spiritual standpoint at all. A spiritual person never wants you to become like him. Never. How he can desire to make you like him? Then you will be false. Then you will be a replica, a carbon copy. A spiritual person wants you to be yourself, original, not a carbon. His whole effort is to help you to become yourself. His whole effort to help you to attain to your destiny. If you are a rose flower, you have to become a rose flower. If you are a lotus, you have to become a lotus. And if you are a marigold, you have to become a marigold. The concern of the spiritual master is that you should flower, not that you should become rose or lotus or marigold. That is not his concern. You should flower. You should bloom. See the difference. The moralist always wants you to become a replica. If he is a rose flower, he would like everybody to become a rose flower. Then what he will do with the marigolds? He will paint the marigolds like rose. He will cut the marigold like rose. He will destroy a natural beauty. A marigold is as beautiful as any rose. Or if you are a lotus and he wants a rose flower just like him, he will cut you utterly. He will destroy you. Or if he is a lotus and you are a rose flower, he will try to extend you, pull you apart. He will force you. And whatsoever happens, it will be wrong. You will become a false thing. The real master helps people to bloom in their own way, to bloom whatsoever they can become. whatsoever they are carrying in themselves. Their hearts should become open, their petals should open. They should not die like seeds or buds, they should bloom. I thought, if only I could reform this man and make him like I am, instead of the degenerate creature which he is. In fact, the people who try to make you like themselves are great egoists. They want their carbon copies. The more carbon copies they have, the more joyful they feel. Then they become the criterion, the ideal. And of course, nobody can fulfill that ideal. So they are always on the top. Remember, nobody can fulfill that. Even if I want to become like you, I cannot fulfill it. It is impossible. It is not in the nature of things to be like somebody else. So if I try to be like you, I will always remain short. And you will remain always higher. If you want to be always higher, then the best trick is to help people to be like yourself. That's what the parents do to their children. They try the children to be like themselves. They can never be. So parents can always feel good that they are high, superior beings. And these degenerate children, this generation has gone wrong. Nobody has gone wrong. Always all parents have felt about children that something has gone wrong. And they are the culprits. They are the real criminals. Because they forced that the child should be like the father. And it is impossible. It is not possible in the very nature of things. So the child cannot do it wholeheartedly. Even if he tries, he will never succeed. And he will never become like his father. So the father can always feel good that he is something so superior that nobody can become like him. And that's what your so-called gurus go on doing. Beware of such gurus. The real master is one who is interested in you as you are and as you should be or you could be. He helps you. He helps you only. His work is that of support. He does not reform you. Remember. He neither reforms you nor informs you. He simply supports you. Information is knowledge. Reformation is trying to manipulate your character. He never informs, never reforms. He simply supports. And his support is unconditional. He says, be thyself. My whole support is there. Unconditional support is there. He is like a gardener who goes on watering the rose plant, the marigold, the lotus. To every plant he goes on watering. When the lotus blooms, he is happy. When the rose blooms, he is happy. When the marigold has bloomed, he is happy. But he is not trying to force any pattern on anybody. At that moment I saw a boat in the river beginning to sink. The other man at once threw himself into the water, where seven people were struggling, and brought six of them safely to the bank. And now Hassan is standing on the banks. Seven people are dying, but his compassion has not arisen. And he thinks he is a man of humility, religiousness, morality. And he wanted to reform this man. And this man has compassion. Compassion is the criterion. When you act in compassion, you show who you are. Now Hassan has not even thought about it. Those people are dying. That idea has not occurred to him. And this man saved six men. Then the man came to me and said, Hassan, if you are a better man than me, in the name of God, save the other man, the last remaining one. The other man is no ordinary man. It is a special Sufi idea. Sufis say that there is a messenger of God, Khijr, who goes on working on people. He is a master of masters. He goes on coming to the earth. Like Jesus comes, like Krishna comes, an avatara, but in a different way. Wherever he is needed, wherever he sees that something potential is and has to be helped, he appears. Down the ages, he appears. This is a very beautiful idea. The meaning has to be understood. It is just a symbol. It simply means whenever a man is really ready to grow, hankers to grow, God comes and helps. That's all. This man is Khijr. He comes to Hasan and says, Hasan, if you are a better man than me, he has read the thoughts. In the name of God, save the other man, the last remaining one. What are you doing here standing? People are dying, and you don't have any compassion for them. Now one is left, you go and save him. In the name of God, try. Sufis have another idea that when a man who has any glimpse of God does anything, he always succeeds. It has to be so. God has to succeed. If you are a man of God, you have to succeed. It is not your success. It is God's success through you. If you are instrumental, then it will happen. Says Hasan, I found that I could not even save one man, and he was drowned. This is just to show, Hasan, that you are yet not an instrument to God. What kind of humbleness is this? A humble man is a hollow bamboo. God flows through him. What kind of humbleness is this? You are too much full of your ego. You could not save a dying man. You could not be used as God's instrument. Now this man said to me, this woman here is my mother, and this wine flask has only water in it. This is how you judge, and this is what you are like. And now he says, don't judge from the appearances. The appearance is not the reality. Don't be deceived by the appearances. The meaning is that whenever you see somebody, what you see is only the outer core, the behavior. You never see the inner man. Please don't judge. The inner man may be totally different. Never judge a man by his behavior, and there is no other thing to judge. You only see the behavior. Now, Hasan has seen this man sitting with a woman. Now, in Mohammedan countries, the faces of the women are covered, so it is very difficult to see whether the woman is old, young, beautiful, ugly. It is difficult. Whether the woman is a woman, that too is very difficult. And Khijr has thrown the curtain from the woman's face and says, look, this is my mother. But just by seeing me sitting alone on this bank with a woman, the idea flashed in your mind that this man is womanizing. And look, this flask has only water in it. Flask gave you the idea that there must be wine in it. And what this man is doing here, whose woman he has got, what kind of debauch he is, a drunkard, a womanizer, and all kinds of ideas flashed in your mind. Just seeing something from the outside, is this the way to judge? And this is what you are like? Never judge, because all that you can see is only the appearance. You only see the surface. The inner man remains hidden. Unless you are capable to see the inner man, don't judge. And remember, those who are capable to see the inner man never judge. They never judge. Because the inner man is always pure. The inner man is purity itself. It is innocence. The inner man has never been impure. So when you can't see the inner, don't judge. And when you can see the inner, there is no way to judge. Judge ye not. I threw myself at his feet and cried out, as you have saved six of these seven in peril, save me from drowning in pride disguised as merit. The stranger said, I pray that God may fulfill your aim. This is how a real master is. He has not even pretended that I will help you. He says, okay, I pray that God may fulfill your aim. A real master functions only as an instrument. A real master effaces himself completely. It is only God that functions through him. Hassan has thrown himself into the feet of this strange man. Hassan is a seeker. That's why Khizr has appeared to help this man. A sincere seeker, but on the wrong path. A sincere seeker, but has got clouded with erroneous ideas. Hence the appearance of Khizr. When there is a sincerity, even if you are wrong, you will find a master. And if there is no sincerity and you are right, then too you will not find the master. Because the master can contact only with a sincere man. The man is a seeker. The Hassan is a great seeker. He went from one master to another. He roamed all over the Sufi countries trying to find out. And he is ready. When somebody says something, he is ready to understand. Immediately he could see the point. That this man has saved six and I could not save even single one. God has given his statement about me, that I am not yet instrumental. Then he didn't resist. He fell down in his feet and said, you saved me, you have saved six, and I am drowning in my pride. You saved me also, otherwise I will be drowned. Khizr said, I pray that God may fulfill your aim. And this is what I say to you too. I pray that God may fulfill your aim. Enough for today.